This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we have a great conversation with Jennifer Coutts Clay about airline cabin designs. She's the author of the remarkable ebook Jetliner Cabins, Evolution and Innovation. Jennifer also gives us some thoughts on the impact of two iconic airplanes, the Boeing 747 and the Concorde. In the news, we discuss cameras in seatback IFE systems, Alaska Airlines and Sisters of the Skies working to bring more diversity to the industry, bringing a gun on a plane, the crash of an Amazon Prime Air Boeing 767, and a new drone marking requirement from the FAA. Also, we announce the winners of the Chicken Wings Comics giveaway. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 541 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. The guys are back. Joining me first is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's also the 2008 CFI of the Year. And of course, he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Hey, great to be back. In fact, it's been such a busy February, I forgot that I was gone. I don't know how this year has gone by so fast already, but all I can say is I'm having fun, being knee-deep in all my different projects.
All right. Also back is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. Aloha, David.
Aloha. I'm glad to be back. It was a great trip. We'll talk a little bit more about it later, but got a lot of flying in, and I had my first experience with slimline seats. We'll give you the 6'4" perspective on those later, a little bit later on.
Very good. Well, our guest this episode is Jennifer Coutts Clay. She's principal at J. Clay Consulting. That's a consultancy that's based on over four decades of pioneering work in the airline industry. Jennifer's also author of Jetliner Cabins, Evolution and Innovation. That's at jetlinercabins.com. Well, in 1979 at British Airways, Jennifer was the first woman to serve as head of operations and sales for Western U.S. After serving as the general manager of product design and development at Pan American World Airlines for 3 years in the late 1980s, Jennifer became a consultant. She provides technical advice and marketing support to the aviation industry with a focus on airline interiors and corporate branding programs. Jennifer's been featured, interviewed, and published by dozens of news media outlets, including the New York Times, Travel and Leisure, Bloomberg Businessweek, Forbes.com, Condé Nast Traveler, and CNN.com. She's a founding sponsor of the Crystal Cabin Awards, a founding member of the Pan American Historical Foundation Museum, and she serves on the Concorde Advisory Committee at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum in New York City. Jennifer, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thank you, Max. I hope I'm going to be able to keep up with you and your namesake, Max Prescott, and David. It'll be a great evening.
We're looking forward to it. Now, those of you listening, some of you will have heard about the Jetliner Cabins ebook from Mary Kirby on the PaxX podcast. Now, Airliner World characterized Jetliner Cabins as the only comprehensive survey of the aircraft cabin environment from the 1970s to the present day. Personally, I think of it as the Bible when it comes to airline interiors. Now, the hardcover book was originally published in 2003. And there was a paperback edition a little bit later. But Jennifer, airline interiors didn't stop evolving then, did they?
Absolutely. This is a subject where there's something happening every single day. And when I brought out the first edition back in 2003, I was very thrilled because I was able to incorporate a number of articles that I had written for aviation magazines. And basically, my work focuses on passenger impact inside the aircraft. And with the paperback edition in 2006, I was able to add in the new generation aircraft, for example, the Boeing 787, the Bombardier C-Series that is now Airbus A220, the Embraer E-Jets, and Airbus A380. And things just kept on developing. So for the third edition, I realized we needed to move from having 500 pictures to a few thousand pictures, which is what we've managed to do with the digitized version. And I think we have about it's about 120,000 words and more than 5,000 pictures now in Jetliner Cabin's Evolution and Innovation. So I'm delighted with the progress. I wish I could keep up with everything that's happening everywhere.
Things are moving for sure. And one thing that I will say about the ebook, Jennifer, and to those of you listening, is this is not an ebook where the author just took a published work and scanned it into a PDF and then said, okay, now I have an ebook. Jetliner Cabin's ebook is filled with links and references. As you mentioned, Jennifer, lots of photographs, contributions by others. It really is an impressive piece of work, and that's kind of why I call it the Bible of the airliner interiors. But we'll talk about that a lot more coming up. Of course, first we're going to start off with some of the aviation news from the past week. So is everybody ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
Thank you, yes.
First item comes from MarketWatch. Airline seats now equipped with cameras aimed at passengers. Oh, Max Trescott, seatback entertainment systems on some American, United, and Singapore Airlines planes apparently have cameras.
Well, there's a certain irony to this, I think, when you consider that we've become a society where everyone's taking selfies and posting on social media and just wants to become famous, and then they get upset that there might be a camera taking their picture. I mean, what's the big deal?
You know, Jennifer, there are a lot of the mainstream press reports on this out there that make this sound like this is, yeah, some kind of a big scary surreptitious kind of a move, but I mean, that's really not what it's all about, is it?
Well, this is a new development, and naturally people get worried. For example, airlines have been very careful in the past to keep information in a documented way that's not publicized, for example, names of people flying. And so you're quite right when you say cameras are just with us these days, and everybody's thrilled when the camera can produce the information that we need. If somebody has broken a shop window or caused a car accident or something like that, and then what happens when I'm in front of the camera? Well, I feel that we're moving ahead into a different way of flying. Everything seems to be more public. And what I would like to see is a smart camera so that if the passenger finds that the tray table is sagging or that the seat cushion is fraying or that the carpet's coming off the floorboards, you know, an intelligent camera, and the passenger can actually pinpoint the problem. And I would like to have that information going straight to head office of the airline maintenance and engineering section so that they would have all the information to deal with on-the-spot repairs and updates and upgrades. I hope the camera could turn out to be useful.
Oh, that's a very interesting application. Now, the airlines say that these cameras are part of the IFE systems that come from suppliers such as Panasonic and Thales. They also say that these cameras are not activated, and the airlines say they don't have any plans to do so, to activate those cameras. But yeah, certainly there are a lot of interesting applications here. And as we've noted, society has become so used to cameras on smartphones this is just kind of an extension of that, I think.
Well, I think they're missing a huge opportunity here. I mean, they need to add just one little button there. And when you press it, it becomes a photo booth application and you get four pictures taken and it just prints them out there. And, you know, it just becomes a record of your trip on the airplane. I mean, let's have fun with this thing.
There you go.
Would you charge ancillary fees then for that service? Because I think it would be very, very attractive to half the millennials who travel every single day.
Well, certainly, certainly it would be free and included in first class.
Oh, but wait till your boss, finds out that in business class you can video conference into the meeting.
No, that would be terrible. That would be awful. That is an interesting application I hadn't thought of.
Yeah. In the article, there's someone who tweeted that they're concerned that someone might be able to hack into them and, you know, take pictures of you or watch you or so forth and so forth. But I don't think that's particularly likely. But as the tweeter mentioned, if you are concerned, there's also this very clever invention called tape that can be placed over the camera pretty easily.
Well, there's another invention called the blanket, you know, just throw it over your head and that way people can't see you at all.
Yeah. Next item, this is Alaska Airlines promises to bring more black women pilots into the fold. Now, as we all know, the travel industry is heavily dominated by white males. Alaska Airlines is committed to hiring more African-American female pilots, and they've teamed up with a nonprofit organization that I had never heard of before. It's called Sisters of the Skies, and they're at sistersoftheskies.org. They are dedicated to taking actions that will result in more black women pilots in the industry. So I think that's very commendable.
I had fun looking at their website, by the way, and one of the things that just really shocked me, we have about 600,000 certificated pilots here in the United States, and according to the sistersoftheskies.org website, only about 150 of them are African-American women holding an ATP certificate, which means they would be qualified to fly as an airline pilot, which, golly, yeah, that's just a handful. I mean, that is so small. So their website, it's clearly devoted toward mentoring and events to help promote flying among this community. And it looks like they've got a great event coming up in Houston on April 27th. And it's going to be for girls who are 10 to 18 to spend a full day experiencing the field of aviation as a professional pilot, including introductory airplane rides, touring the air traffic control tower, meeting mentors and friends. And of course, the most important thing for being a pilot, and I'm sure you all know what that is, and they're going to have food there.
Yeah. Pilots always are attracted to food, I guess, or potential pilots.
Actually, what I meant was flight instructor. You can buy off any flight instructor with a hot dog.
Okay.
Could I just jump in on the Intrepid Museum of Sea, Air, and Space here in New York City? There are wonderful simulators, and the Intrepid gets, you know, a steady stream of visitors, not just from New York City, but from all over the world. And I think that all these aviation museums are equipped to encourage youngsters to come in to see what happens in the magical world of aviation. We're talking about something that's difficult to describe in words sometimes, but once you've had your hands on, the exterior of the aircraft, if you get a chance to get inside, as you can, for instance, at the Intrepid, you can walk through Concorde and you can sit in the captain's seat, things do change in your brain. And so I think this is a time for aviation museums to step up and look at the different opportunities with local school groups. So that's what I would hope we would see over the next few years.
Yes, exactly. And I recall a conversation I had, I think it was last year, up at the New England Air Museum And when I was talking with some folks up there, and one of the points that they were making is that you, when you're doing that, you have to be cognizant of what kinds of things interest today's youth. And if you just, you know, think about or plan around what might have attracted you at an event like that or visiting a museum, it's not going to play very well in many cases with today's youngsters. You know, and,
so food doesn't work anymore, huh?
Well, I don't know. Maybe those little guys are hungry too. But you know, the example was the information, printed information, display signs and so forth around aircraft that describe things. And whereas, you know, you or I might be perfectly happy to stand there and read through it and learn that way. Today's youth are not going to do that, and so you have to find other ways to hold their interest. But doing that is of course, I think, key to getting folks interested, getting youngsters interested in aviation at a young age.
That's a good point. The pictures are so important these days. I call them the I generation, meaning EYE, because they're guided, you know, by the pictures, and then they'll go and read the words. Whereas the way I was brought up, and maybe this applies to your schooling as well, I would read the words and then look at the pictures. That's what we were told to do in school. And I do think that the big hook for youngsters is travel itself, the concept of travel, the idea of being able to go to different parts of the world as an air traveler. So I think there is a platform there to encourage youngsters to come into the aviation museums. I noticed that at the Intrepid, they sort of gather around. They like looking at route network diagrams. They like looking at things. So the idea of tempting them and trying to encourage them to think globally, that's something that the aviation museums are very, very well positioned to handle.
Yes, I think so.
I must have missed a word there. You said route network diagrams. What do you mean by that?
Well, when, for instance, if you look at the old route network of Imperial Airways, for instance, going all the way down to South Africa with the flying boats,
right.
At the it's at Roosevelt Field on Long Island, the aviation museum there, where Pan Am has an exhibit, Garden City. They showed the 314, the Boeing, wonderful aircraft, and they showed the routes where the Boeing 314 operated. And I noticed that particularly youngsters, I've seen this in other museums as well, they just like looking at how these airlines went from coast to coast across the United States, in some cases went over the ocean to Asia or went across the Atlantic. So I think that's one of the attractions for youngsters, the idea of being able to travel. After all, they all want to sign up to travel somewhere for their holidays. So I see that as a major way of attracting youngsters to the business of aviation.
That's a great insight. Thanks for clarifying that for me. And I had to chuckle here a little bit. I'm at a severe disadvantage. When you said that, you probably didn't know that my background is as an engineer working for a computer company. So when you said a network diagram, I just thought, you know, it was showing how all those computers on the you know, the aircraft carrier were connected together.
Oh, wow. Well, you're quite right, because in the computer world, networks and routings, yes, but don't you think maybe the terminology has derived from aviation, and maybe the earlier use of the word network and route?
You know, there's a real interesting correlation, because you're right. In some ways, those diagrams are similar. So that's a really good point.
All right. Well, I don't know how to make a transition from that to this next story, so I'll just jump right in.
Let me make it for you. We have been going from from frivolous to more serious as we progressed in our news today.
This is from sfgate.com. Man's gun reportedly stolen from SFO baggage carousel. What happened here, Mr. Trescott?
Yeah, this was kind of stunning to me, but in another way it wasn't so surprising. And, of course, everything worked exactly as it was supposed to work, except that somebody got a free gun from the San Francisco baggage carrier just up the road here from where I'm sitting right now. There was a gentleman who was a firearms instructor. I guess he teaches law enforcement agencies the use of firearms. He was traveling over the weekend from Las Vegas to the San Francisco Bay Area with his gun in tow, and it was packaged appropriately. It was in a locked and labeled container. It was in the baggage, hold of the airliner that he was flying. I won't mention that it was United Airlines. And then he apparently, for whatever reason, was not able to get on that flight, and I don't recall, why. But his bag made it, and so his bag got here before he did, and it sat going around the carousel for hours until someone said, that looks like a gun container going around unattended for hours on a carousel. So somebody apparently walked over and walked off with it. So, yeah, it kind of highlights a hole in the system, and rather an amazing one at that.
Now, just by coincidence, we'd been corresponding with Wesley Oakes, and Wesley has a blog. It's called Gun Goals, and it's a site that's dedicated to gun enthusiasts. And he has a post, 9 Must-Do Tips for Flying with a Gun. So this was our discovery of this was very timely. And people may not be aware, but I think most folks listening to this know that you can't bring a gun in your carry-on luggage, but if you are traveling with a gun, it has to go in checked baggage. It has to be in a locked and hard-sided container.
Unless, of course, you're the pilot, in which case it's yes. Up there up front with you.
With you, right.
Yeah, the bullets have to be removed from the gun itself. The bullets
yes.
sort of can't travel in the gun. They have to be separate and not inside the gun. So yes, there are very strict regulations. So how did this happen at with that airline that you didn't want to name? How come the regulations were not observed?
Well, I think the regulations were observed in this case, but one of the tips in this list of 9 is about the container that you put it in. And this gentleman's recommendation is don't put it in a container that looks like a gun case, because then it's obvious that it's a gun case. Maybe put it in something else. I thought it was interesting to learn that, it's no surprise that the container has to be locked, but you cannot use one of those TSA locks. You're supposed to put a lock on there that only you have the key to, so that the TSA agents are not able to open that up and get to the gun. But it's a good list of tips. He talks about you need to declare the gun at check-in. They'll have you fill out a declaration form. The TSA may want to come and look in your box before it's taken away. So you should probably, remain in that area for a period of time. He said that most of the time the firearm shows up on the carousel along with everybody else's baggage, but occasionally it doesn't. And then, except for this case that we were just talking about, they'll have it in the office. But he also says to check with your airline beforehand, because they may have some specific rules that they have, and you want to make sure that you comply with those. So it's a great, it's an informative post if you're traveling with a firearm. His blog is gungoals.com. We'll put a link to the article in the show notes, but it's gungoals.com/flying-with-a-gun. Check that out if you have a need to travel with a firearm. And on a sad note, I think probably everyone has seen in the press, Amazon Prime Air 767 crashes in Texas. This is from CNN. It's a Dash 300 operated by Atlas Air for Amazon Prime Air, and it crashed in Texas in a kind of a swampy, muddy kind of environment.
Yeah, it's certainly confounding. And of course, it's very early, so we don't really know much about this crash, except that the aircraft, which was, I believe, traveling from Miami to Houston, it was seemingly on a normal track, though it was headed to higher density of heavy rain. And they may have at that point just started to either warn the pilots of the rain or may have actually started talking about vectoring them around them. So there is some possibility that maybe they had a, you know, a dual flame out if they had incredibly heavy rain at that particular point, or severe turbulence and lost control. Who knows? It really is totally unknown at this point. What is known is that it dropped nearly 7,000 feet in under a minute. And so it was, and there were no calls from the from the aircraft as to what happened. So incredibly tragic. This is the first time we've had a air cargo crash here in the U.S. for about 6 years, I think. These are incredibly rare, as are, you know, crashes with the 767, which has a relatively good record. I think it's had a total of 6 crashes since it was introduced back in 1981.
The NTSB GO team is on site. There are different reports. Supposedly there's a video, I think that was taken from a prison security camera, but that hasn't been released. And some are saying that the mud and muck in this particular location may make it really difficult to retrieve the black boxes, because they wouldn't be just submerged in water. They'd be buried in mud, and that might be more difficult to detect them. So that retrieval might be complicated by that fact. So
I bet they'll find them. I think with a situation like this, they will do everything humanly possible to try and figure out what happened with this aircraft, and getting those black boxes is crucial to that effort.
Sure, sure. And they will find them. I think it's just the question, or the issue being raised, is it may take a lot long. Well, it may take longer than we might think, given the fact that the conditions there are such that they are. But we'll see. All right. And David, we have a little bit of drone news.
Yeah, we wouldn't normally talk about this on this show, but this is kind of a big deal. As of, we're recording this on Monday. As of today, if you're flying a drone, you have to have it registered, and you have to have it registered and numbered on the actual aircraft. So you're November number should be on the actual drone itself, which is the newest regulation. So go out there and take out your stickers or your pens or whatever you need to do, and make sure you label your drone with your registration number.
Right. Previously, you could put that registration number somewhere inside the drone, in the battery tray or something like that. But what's happening here is now that needs to be on the outside of the drone. I'm still trying to wrap my head around what that's going to achieve exactly, but that's the requirement. There's a quote from Brendan Shulman. He's at DJI now, the Vice President of Policy and Legal Affairs. He worked on the FAA's UAS Registration Task Force back in 2015, and back then his recommendation was internal registration numbers. And the argument then, he said, was as a privacy protection method for drone pilots, including teenagers. He said in the event that drone owner information was made public, as it is for traditional manned aircraft, he says, while we supported reasonable, inexpensive registration for accountability purposes, we did not want a registration number that could be viewed on the drone to lead people to home addresses. So that was the argument. But the other question, of course, David, is who's going to enforce this?
Yeah. besides the fact the FAA doesn't have an enforcement arm, I don't know. I mean, that's one of those things where we need to work that out. But in case somebody is enforcing it, make sure that you have your drone clearly labeled. Now, if it's a micro drone like Max and I have, then you don't need to worry about it. So your normal quadcopter, you need to be registered. So we'll follow this through, and I'm sure that if you want to learn more, you can listen to that show on Friday. It's called the UAV Digest.
Well, and let's just talk about the two different kinds of registration numbers, just to be clear on this. So a while back, the FAA required that all drone operators get a registration number that's tied to the operator, not to the individual drone. So I have one of those numbers, and I could have 10 drones. No, I don't have that many. That would be sufficient for all 10 of those, provided I'm not using them for commercial operations. Once you get into commercial operations, then you require an N number for your drone, much like any other aircraft in the U.S. would have an N number.
And so what's going on here is they're talking about the registration number, aren't they, on the outside of the drone?
You know, I'm not sure which they're talking about, but I just wanted to clarify. You've got two different kinds of numbers, and it's really easy to confuse the two.
Okay.
That's a good question. I need to research that because it's like, what number are we putting on there? Are you putting that number on all 10 of your drones, your personal number, versus if you're commercial, you're adding – clearly you're adding the aircraft number.
Yeah.
So –
and that's what I'm here for, to help the two drone guys out with these questions.
they confuse us even more.
Yeah.
Well, I think United States is further ahead than UK, because recently, as you know, aircraft movements came to a complete standstill at Gatwick and at Heathrow because of reports of drones flying in the vicinity. And they did get pictures, but they weren't able to identify where the drone had come from or who it belonged to. And so there's talk now of new legislation, new regulations, but it sounds as though here in the United States they've already walked along that path to try to get identification, which is stage one, made transparent. Surely that's one of the most important things. But the frightening effects of these drone intrusions in the Gatwick and Heathrow areas just brought the country to a complete standstill at the time.
And we had a similar incident here in the U.S. At Newark Airport back on January 22nd. A Southwest flight spotted a drone, and that airport was shut down for some time. So, yes, it can happen anywhere.
Yes. Again, we're speaking with Jennifer Coutts Clay, principal at J. Clay Consulting, also author of Jetliner Cabins, Evolution and Innovation. Jennifer, again, welcome to the show. Just as a simple baseline for everybody, then we'll get into some much more detail. But when an airline is procuring aircraft, they have pretty much complete control over the interior of the aircraft. They can configure it in ways that they desire for their objectives, for their strategies and business purposes, correct?
Yes, Max, that's right. They can do that. That would be far more expensive than going along the road recommended by, let's say, the OEM, Airbus or Boeing, Embraer, Bombardier. Because there's buyer-furnished equipment and seller-furnished equipment, and the manufacturers offer certain packages with seller-furnished equipment. That could be overhead bins, could be galleys, could be lavatories, could be seats, could be carpets, could be anything. And then the airline makes up its own mind what it's going to do for marketing reasons. The airline has to think about the competitive situation. How are they going to be better than or meet the standards of the main competitors on the main routes of the route network? They also have to think about escalating regulatory requirements, safety certification requirements. And so the airline has to decide how much money it's going to spend and why, and on which items. So usually what happens, you get a kind of combination of seller-furnished equipment for the cabin from the manufacturer, and then the airline might make a decision on particular seats, on configuration, certainly, and whether they want to have big galleys, hot galleys, small galleys, no galleys. And so that's how the business works, basically.
I would imagine that one of the initial decisions for the airline is how many classes are they going to provide on that airplane? Is it going to be a three-class configuration or a two-class configuration? And the economic or competitive imperatives for that have really changed over time.
You're so right. The easiest is one class because then you've got commoditization and all the seats on your 737, let's say, or your A20 will be exactly the same. And so they're able to buy in bulk. We're looking at economy of scale and ease of implementation, installation, application, maintenance, number of parts in the parts register, repairs, what are you going to keep in engineering stores in the way of spares. So simplest is all one class. And in the very early days, they didn't have all these different classes like premium economy and these variations that we see these days. They had, for example, when the 747 was launched by Pan Am in January 1970, it was a small cabin, well, A zone and B zone first class, and the rest, C, D, and E zones, all economy. So two classes in the aircraft, that was regarded as a very practical way of running the business. And they called that thrift class, by the way, for C, D, and E zone in the Pan Am documents at the time.
One of the interesting aspects of the different cabin classes, I think, is how they've changed over time in terms of the amenities, the service that they offer. And sometimes we have seen how things that are characteristic of, let's say, first class end up flowing down into business class and from business class to coach.
Right. I call this trickle-down product upgrades. And you're quite right. Business class now in major airlines, talking about American Airlines, Delta, United, British, Air France, Lufthansa, business class now, in many cases, is better than first class 10, 15 years ago. Mm. And the airlines have moved in this direction because they have to look at where the money comes from. And the revenues from business class travel are of enormous significance. They really pay the way. This is the bread and butter of the business. And so anything that can be done to help business travelers, they will get top priority. So what's happened to first class? Well, some of these major airlines are holding on to maybe a couple of rows of first class, a small cabin possibly for first class. Some of them are actually getting rid of first class. Qantas did that on a number of their aircraft not long ago. That's a very egalitarian society, but I don't think we're going to see the Middle East airlines getting rid of first class in a hurry because they have customers who want to travel in a first class cabin with all the wonderful amenities, accoutrements, and support, the hot and cold running showers, the butler, the sliding panels for privacy, the computer terminals so you can order your double martini or whatever it is you want to eat or drink. They don't want to give up the idea of first class travel. For them, it's important to arrive as a first class passenger in order to be on a par with their counterparts in other parts of the world or to present their country in the very best possible way. So there is a future for first class, but it's not the way it used to be. And business class is the king cabin these days. So much focus and attention goes into business class travel now. It's wonderful for business travelers.
I thought it was interesting in Jetliner Cabins how you described how the corporate travel budgets can actually influence cabin design. In going back to a time in the past when fears of recession caused corporate travel departments to start strategies or to implement rules restricting first-class travel, let's say, for most of the employees.
Yes. What happens in company, the corporate travel department gets an edict from the chairman or the chief financial officer or somebody in charge, somebody very important, saying, we're slashing budgets and your budget is being slashed by 18.5% or 25% or 30% over the next 6 months or 12 months or whatever. So corporate travel operators, these hardworking people, have to then look at all the airfares. They have to take people, they have forward bookings, of course, advanced bookings, because they know about their business travel requirements for regular meetings in different parts of the world and for scheduled coverage of the business. And so they just downgrade people. They say, oh, well, you were booked in business, you're now going to be in premium economy, or you're booked in premium economy, you're now going to be in economy. And that is company policy. And so what the airlines do when you get these, we call them, in England they're called swinging cuts, because they sort of chop through everything, the airlines flex, they are organic, and they then start to think of different ways of holding on to the business, holding on to revenues, and then they change the names of the cabins and the classes of fares. So, for instance, premium economy was brought in. It was EVA and Virgin Atlantic that pioneered premium economy, rapidly followed by British Airways and United, and then the other airlines, because corporate executives were being told, you can't fly in business because of budget cutbacks, and economy simply wasn't suitable for somebody traveling maybe 10, 12 hours and then maybe two other flights to a remoter area, and then expecting to go to a business meeting on arrival. So there was obviously a need for something between the old business class, the existing economy class, and that's how premium economy emerged. And now we do see many airlines installing premium economy cabins, which are distinct from, they're separate from economy. They've got hard panel dividers, not just curtain dividers. And then different standards of service, much greater pitch. It could be 36, 37, 38-inch pitch. Better recline on the seats, could be more than 2.5 inches, could be 4 or 5 inches, and maybe meals on demand. So the airlines look at these opportunities and develop new classifications, and it's a way of holding on to the passengers, holding on to the business.
You mentioned hard panel dividers. And I think that the difference between a hard panel divider and a curtain divider, which in some ways sounds like it is maybe trivial, can really have a significant impact on how the passengers perceive the space that they're in.
You're so right. And passengers like to be in their own group. They don't want to be invaded by the others. And they want to feel that they're safe and sound and they deserve to be cosseted and looked after. After all, they've paid a lot of money. And so they're in their own zone and they're alongside other people who are in their zone. It makes a big difference.
I want to get to seats, of course, and especially hear what David has to say about his slim line seat experience.
But slim line seats.
Yes, yes. But before we do that, and just to kind of continue with the perception that passengers have, you talk about the large impact of small items, the minor miscellaneous items, or MMIs. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, MMIs, your list could be endless. We're talking headrest covers, cushion covers, tray liners, cocktail napkins, cocktail stir sticks. These items make a big difference to the passengers. The passengers often hold on to their cocktail stirrers and their cocktail napkins and their menus, for instance, their amenity kits, as a lasting souvenir, and their little treasure, really, after the flight. And usually these items are passed to family members or children of neighbors or along to the local school for a chat on somebody's journey to Japan or India or whatever was happening. And so you don't have to have all the safety certification processes for your minor miscellaneous items. And the other point is that you can get marketing tie agreements where outside marketing partners will pay to have their name on the cocktail napkins so the airline isn't paying. For example, Coca-Cola does that a lot in different parts of the world. And so MMI, it's a wonderful area of the business to be responsible for. I was for a time at British Airways, I have to tell you. And you have lots of options. And, of course, seasonal changes make a big difference. And then celebrating the major public holidays of the airline's home country, for example. You have a chance to serve Christmas pudding at Christmas time or special curries on, you know, Indian routes. And it's a tremendous range of activity that doesn't cost a massive amount. It could cost money, but usually these items are not expensive. You have to be very careful because you're ordering a lot of tray liners and a lot of headrest covers. But this can make all the difference to the passengers. They're in contact with the branding of the airline, the identity of the airline, and it's something that passengers relate to.
And oftentimes when the passenger steps off the jet, what they think about the experience can be based around just a few touch points.
Right, the customer touch points. And I did try to describe in my book the whole process of sight and sound and smell and touching, tactile experience inside the aircraft. And the feelings and taste, of course, if food is being served. They call it neuromarketing these days. That's the fancy new phrase. But we used to say customer touch points in Pan Am and in British Airways. And ingenious marketers can think up different ways of reaching the psyche of the passengers. Pan Am, for instance, launched the first dedicated branded business class cabin. That was Clipper Class. And that was at the end of the 70s. And people loved those Clipper Class bag tags, for instance. They still go around with them. You can buy them on eBay. They are still regarded as souvenirs. The Clipper Class there were Clipper Class menus, there were Clipper Class giveaways, Clipper Class amenity kits, but these bag tags still pop up in different places. And when you go through JFK Airport, for instance, there is a store there that sells Pan Am memorabilia, and you can see the Clipper Class items, bags and things at that JFK store. So, yes, these customer touch points are more powerful than we might imagine.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about seats. David, you, on your trip to or from Hawaii, experienced a slimline seat. Was that the first time you'd been in a seat like that?
Actually, yes. Surprisingly, I was in two different versions. I had, from Philadelphia to Phoenix, I was on an A320. Standard seats. And then I flew a 7-5 from Phoenix to Hawaii, both on American. that was a standard experience. I then flew Inner Island on Hawaiian Air, a 717, and that was my first experience with slimline seats. And ready for this? I actually thought they were comfortable. I was really sort of surprised, and there was enough seat pitch on the flight to Hawaii, on the Hawaiian flight, that I actually enjoyed it. I believe it or not, sat in windows, but it was a really kind of comfortable flight. Now, my flight home from Kona to LAX was on a brand new Airbus A325 ETOPS with in-flight actually had a full in-suite. That was a very comfortable flight. Unfortunately, then I got a A320 that was loaded to the brim max with a different slimline seat for my red eye. And I was actually in an exit row. So I actually had extra leg room, but unfortunately I had a larger person sitting next to me who was flowing into the seat. So I did not really sleep well on my red eye from LAX to PHL last week. And it was not conducive to sleeping. It felt even tighter on the American Airlines seat from LAX to PHL than it did on the Hawaiian seats. Now, mind you, the Hawaiian flight was only 45 minutes. But that being said, I still think I probably could have slept in the Hawaiian seat, but the American Airlines slimline seat was uncomfortable.
That's a very interesting set of comparisons. And one thing that pops up there, old-style slimline seats and the newer-style slimline seats. Hawaiian Airlines has been doing very well recently and has put in a lot of work on upgrading their cabins. And what's happened with these slimline seats, they started out as being pretty uncomfortable. There were complaints. And the foams were old-style foams. Now, with the new-style slimline seats, the foams are more high-tech, and they are constructed in a different way. The latest foams have got a sort of honeycomb construction inside them so that the weight gets distributed more evenly, and passengers can move and wriggle and squiggle, and the honeycomb is always sort of cradling them. Whereas the old-style foams were a bit like thick blankets in a way and didn't really react to the body moving. And so now with new slimline seats, there's a big effort to put in these high-tech, clever foams. And yes, the passengers do say that these seats are comfortable. Of course, pitch is part of it. If my knees are banging into the back of the seat in front of me, I will feel uncomfortable, even if I've got high-tech foam in my slimline seat. And another point is, where is the in-flight literature pocket? If they've left that down at my knee level, that pocket is occupying 2 or 3 inches of space that I ought to have. That's the way I would feel. Many of the literature pockets now have been moved further up the seat back so that they don't occupy that valuable bit of space where my knees are hitting the back of the seat in front of me. So all these items come together, and you've just described a very interesting situation where you were able to make comparisons rapidly between those individual flights. My guess is that the older foams will eventually get replaced with the high-tech, comfortable foams.
Are the slimline seats less expensive for the airline than the old seats?
Ooh, that's a difficult question, because in purchasing programs, these purchase agreements are quantity sensitive to a great degree. So an airline like American, with hundreds of aircraft, hundreds and hundreds, can make excellent deals, whereas a smaller airline, Hawaiian is a much smaller airline, for instance, they would be paying more per unit than a big airline. And so that's something to keep in mind. Of course, the best time to put in anything new is when the aircraft's coming off the production line. And this goes back to your earlier point about seller-furnished equipment and an airline saying, but we don't want those foams that you've been using all the time in those seats. We want these new foams. Then it would become buyer-furnished. The airline is buying the foams for the seats. So the pricing, just in general, economy class seats have come down in weight. They used to be 12, 15K or even more. Now they're under 10K, and the very latest economy style seats are advertised as being somewhere around 5 or 4 point something kilograms. I'm talking kilos. And no, the prices don't go down because the seat is lighter. They're using, carbon fiber composites. They use titanium to bring the weight down, because that way the airline is able to show fuel savings on the jet fuel for every chunk of weight that you remove from the old style seat, so that in a way it's better to go to the new style seats, because you're going to save so much jet fuel. If you've got 130 something economy class seats and you can reduce the weight from over 10 kilograms to, let's say, 8, 7, 6 kilograms per seat, we're talking commoditization again, you can measure that in dollars for the jet fuel. And so it all becomes promising for the airline, and the bigger the airline, the better they're able to achieve economy of scale and get really significant discounts.
These are examples, I think, of how cabin interiors is not a static proposition. There are always developments taking place. Suppliers are coming up with new ideas, new materials, new marketing pressures, new competitive pressures. And it really is a kind of a fluid environment. Another area that we might touch on is the desire for airlines to be green and to develop interiors that are maybe greener than what we've seen in the past.
Well, this is the biggest chapter in my book, because there's so much happening in this field. My chapter has nearly 100 pictures and more than 10,000 words. It's the longest chapter I've ever written in my life. And the only reason I stopped was because I thought, maybe people will get bored. The subject didn't stop. You know, there were still other things that I didn't get round to. But yes, we can do a lot inside the aircraft, and particularly economy class. Why? Because this is usually the largest section of the interior of the aircraft, and we're talking commoditization. So, for example, when AmSafe reduced the weight of their seatbelt, which is on most of the airlines of the world, they're very pleased. I remember they announced they'd reduced the weight of the seatbelt by 25%. And, I said, so, that's wonderful. We cut off these huge hems. We've still got the requisite length for the bands, you know, the seatbelt itself. But instead of having a great big fat turn back of a hem occupying quite a few inches, we've shortened the hems, and we've used lighter weight material for the buckle. We still comply with all safety certification requirements, and the weight is 25% lighter than before. Well, of course, the airlines were delighted, because if they're flying thousands of economy class seats in a week, they can measure that weight reduction, and they can relate that to jet fuel. And then if jet fuel is reduced, we get the consequent reduction in carbon emissions. So the airline then is better positioned to meet its targets. And what else is there that's green? Well, now Mohawk, for instance, here in the United States, recyclable carpets that can be dry cleaned virtually on the aircraft, and the carpets then move on to commercial use, for example, inside the airport, and LED lighting instead of the old style fluorescent or incandescent or halogen or neon. These lighting installations last easily 12 years, probably more now. There are some wonderful developments, fabrics that can be laundered even in cold water. They don't have to go to the dry cleaners where you're using Freon and gas the whole time. So there are lists of items now that can make the aircraft, and in particular the economy class cabin, much more green. I read recently that Norwegian apparently is the most green airline on the Atlantic. I don't know all the details, but apparently they have studied this. And in the United States, Southwest developed what's called the Evolve program. Gary Kelly allocated a 737 for the Southwest specialists to try out different ways of achieving weight reduction, particularly, and installing fabrics and cabinetry and lockers and surface coverings that meet the green standards. And that was called the Evolve program. That's described in my chapter 15.
Fascinating. Well, Jennifer, as we start to wind down the time that we have with you this episode, if you look ahead into the future, are there trends that kind of stand out in your mind?
Well, the main trend is responsible air travel. And we do see much more focus now on sourcing of materials. And airlines now want to know how the materials have been fabricated, how they've been dealt with so that they can achieve weight reductions. And these are the savings that I described, for instance, laundering instead of dry cleaning, let's say, so that they will be able to make savings. They'll be able to measure the weight savings in terms of jet fuel advantages and the consequent reduction in carbon emissions. Also, there's much more emphasis now on accessibility and looking after passengers with special needs. I see that as a subject that's going to, it's not going to go away. People are going to take that more seriously. Business travel is looking great. Business travelers have better cabins now than ever in the history of aviation. And that's wonderful for all these important passengers who are the bread and butter of the business. And again, that's not going to go away. So yes, improved business travel, probably the development of other market segments like premium economy or large seats, or seats with extra pitch, and individualization, more personalization, more humanization of the business. So those are the main trends, I think, that we can see evolving.
All right, very good. Well, it feels like we've touched on a number of different topics, but we've really only scratched the surface of what you have in the Jetliner Cabins book. So we invite our listeners to take a look at that, jetlinercabins.com. And, you know, in some ways, even if you're not a, you know, a commercial aviation nut, even if you're not a PaxX or a aircraft interiors enthusiast, it is so fascinating to read about these things from a historical standpoint, from the perspective of what airlines are trying to achieve in these areas and others. I mean, everything. We didn't even talk about food color schemes or lighting or, you know, all of these kinds of things that are sound like they might be kind of simple concepts until you look at them in detail and understand really how complex they are and how they affect the profitability of the airline, the perception of the flyers, and, you know, many, many other things. So thank you, Jennifer, for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Max, for going into these details, and congratulations on your show, because as you say, you covered a great number of items with Max, and with David. I felt very privileged to be able to join in that part of your show where they are the experts. And thank you so much for your interest in jetliner cabins. As you can tell, I am biased. I think this is a wonderful subject. I hope that all your travels will be comfortable in the jetliner cabins where you're flying. So thank you very much for your invitation. That's very kind. Thank you.
Thank you. One other thing, maybe a little addendum, is something that we didn't get to touch on, the 747 and the Concorde. The 747 we've been talking about lately because of the 50th anniversary of the first flight of the 747. And of course, the Concorde, the iconic aircraft, gone for a while now, but we're seeing renewed interest maybe in supersonic transports, a lot of development work going on in that arena. Both the 747 and the Concorde changed the passenger experience in significant ways, different ways, I guess. I would characterize them as being completely different ways. Would you say that?
Well, you're right. The Boeing 747 brought in, it ushered in the era of mass affordable travel. This was a vision of One Trip, who was the very brilliant chief executive of Pan Am. And he wanted an aircraft that would be three times bigger than his Boeing 707s, which had been very, very successful. And so with Boeing and the huge team headed by Joe Sutter, who's called the father of the 747, they brought out this enormous aircraft, the like of which had never been seen before. It was the largest aircraft in its day that had ever been built. And people don't realize that Boeing thought the world, the main international air routes of the world, would be covered by supersonic transport. They had their own supersonic program at that time. The Russians had a supersonic program, and there was the Anglo-French Concorde program on the go. And so that nose, they call it the weird hump, the shape of the front of the Boeing 747, and the width of the cabin, we're talking about a mouth that can board standard-sized cargo containers, two at a time, sliding all the way into the main deck and into the cargo deck. So that aircraft was built with a second-level agenda to haul cargo. And of course, many of the 747s that have been retired over the last few years do exactly that. They haul cargo. But for passengers, we're talking about the glory days of air travel, because suddenly with thrift class, as they called it in Pan Am, I know from the Pan Am documents, here was the Boeing 747 with more than 300 economy class seats. That was nine abreast, and they had about 50-something first class in A and B zone, and at that time the upper deck was a very, very elegant cocktail bar exclusively for first-class passengers. And the Boeing 747 opened up travel. I remember seeing one flying in my first sight of a Boeing 747 flying into Heathrow, and people were saying, it looks like an apartment block, horizontal apartment block. We just couldn't believe the size. And of course, that the airports, the passenger handling facilities had to be extended and adapted to deal with these huge passenger numbers at Idlewild Kennedy. They used to do double-door boarding at Pan Am, at the airports where they were able to handle double-door boarding. And then if you look at Concorde, Concorde did cover the main business international route, which is London-New York. Concorde was designed for the Atlantic. It was designed for business travel and top-class creme de la creme travel. After all, covering the Atlantic in 3 hours, 20 minutes, instead of, let's say, 7 hours, that made a difference. In those days, they didn't have computers and fancy emails. They had to physically go from place to place, these top-level entertainment lawyers, business accountants, to sign documents and to visit their clients, to be on the spot personally. That life doesn't exist now because so much work is handled over the computer networks. But in I'm talking about Concorde started to fly in 1976. It flew until 2003. During the 80s and 90s, that was the heyday of top-level travel. And particularly for business travelers, to be able to cover the Atlantic 3 hours 20 minutes, no jet lag, because pressurization of Concorde was at 5,500 feet. And whenever you see pictures of people coming off Concorde, have you noticed they're always beaming and smiling and looking energetic?
Yes.
Whereas if you see people coming off a 7 or 8 or 10 hour flight, they're not beaming and smiling and jumping around and looking energetic. Usually they're a bit tired, you know, and sort of, they're looking forward to putting their feet up or having a rest. You never heard that from a Concorde passenger. There were Concorde passengers who made the journey twice in a day because it meant they didn't have to spend the money for a hotel in Washington, D.C. or Manhattan and then the ground transport in both directions and the meals. They just came in on the first Concorde in the morning and went out on the last Concorde at the end of the day. Some of them said that was less expensive than doing the overnight and certainly less stressful than doing the overnight at the New York end and Washington, D.C. end. So there was this wonderful time during the 80s and 90s when everybody was being looked after. You talked about the different classes of travel, the magic of Concorde for Concorde passengers. And I personally worked on Concorde in the hangars, on the gantries, 5 o'clock in the morning in the hangars when we were putting leather seat covers on for the first time on Concorde. That was in the early 80s. And then you look at the way the Boeing 747 has just flown everywhere in the world. It's this serene presence of this ginormous aircraft, and airlines were able to install dining rooms like Pan Am Dining in the Sky. They were able to install special lounges like the Continental 747, lovely lounges, cocktail lounges. American Airlines had a piano. Well, it wasn't a piano, it was a Wurlitzer organ and a leader who led sing-alongs. So suddenly, the marketing ingenuity could run riot. It was wonderful in those days for airlines to think about how to look after the different passengers. I've just been writing about densification, and Pan Am on New York San Juan route put in 10 abreast and all economy and flew something like 460 economy class passengers, 10 abreast. And that was 1973. And 1976, Japan got the short-range 747 and flying something like 480. And then they got a domestic version of the 747, and they were flying well over 500 passengers. They had a first class in the upper deck lounge, but on their domestic routes to Okinawa, to Osaka. And that 747 aircraft, which I love, has, I think, done more for globalization and good things in the world than almost anything else I could imagine. I think we all have reasons to be grateful to the 747.
Well said. I think it was Mario Andretti who was fond of the Concorde. If I remember correctly, and our listeners will correct me if I'm wrong, if I remember correctly, I think one year he raced the Formula One race in Monaco, got himself to a Concorde, flew to the United States, and then raced the Indianapolis 500 in the same day.
I think there was something like that. You're right. But for instance, Phil Collins.
My other example would be Phil Collins for Live Aid, did the morning concert in London and flew to JFK via Concorde, and then they helicoptered him down to Philly at JFK.
Right. Yes. Well, these stories are amazing, but Concorde made that possible. And all the passengers said when they came off Concorde, they felt full of energy. They didn't feel that they wanted to go put their feet up and have a snooze. They all felt they wanted to go to a party or something like that.
Yes, amazing. All right. Well, again, Jennifer, thanks so much. We really appreciate it. You're one of those fascinating people that we could talk to for hours and hours. So maybe we'll have to have you back someday.
Thank you. It's been great to talk with you and Max Prescott and with David. And thank you for your interest in jetliner cabins. And I do hope to speak with you at some time in the future. It's been a lovely way to have a chat with you on this occasion. And many thanks.
Oh, our pleasure, Jennifer. Thanks again.
Wow, that was great. I was absolutely grinning as Jennifer was talking about the days of flying on the Concorde and what an experience that was like and kind of wishing that I had done it. And I realized as I was listening to it, it was kind of like listening to stories about the glory years of, you know, years gone past. It's probably not dissimilar from the stories that were told, you know, back in the 60s about the glory days of plying the oceans in the famous ocean liners, the Queen Mary and, you know, the Queen Elizabeth and things like that. So it's kind of interesting that in some ways an era has passed, but hopefully it'll come back around full circle someday when we get some new supersonic airliners.
Yeah, no doubt. Or maybe the new supersonic airliners, if we do get them, will create their own somewhat different amazing experiences, you know, because the world has changed. All right, we need to talk about our Chicken Wings Comics giveaway. The deadline has come and gone. We had a bunch of folks submit their favorite Chicken Wings comic to our drawing, and we have our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari, to give us the results.
Thanks, Max. And the winner of our Chicken Wings comics giveaway is drumroll, Max. Where's the orchestra?
Launchpad, we don't have an orchestra.
Max, we don't have a live band?
No band.
Fallon has a live band. Colbert has a live band. We should have a live band.
We don't have the budget for a live band.
Max West, can you play drums?
No, afraid not.
Okay, here, hang on. And the winners are... Joshua Freeman... and Ray Davis, congratulations. We'll be emailing both of you to get your home mailing addresses and send you your books. Thanks to all who entered. And keep listening. We're going to have more contests in the future. Back to you, Max.
You know, the interesting thing about those two winners, and Launchpad did a random, you know, a random selection method, is that one of them is a brand new listener. And one of them is a long-time listener. So we kind of span the spectrum there. Josiah, he wrote in his entry, he'd only just started listening to you guys, he said, and just discovered Chicken Wings. Grateful for both. He says, this one definitely speaks to me. It's the one about the toolbox, you know, the restraining order and the in the toolbox and all. So that was fun.
Well, you know the great thing about just discovering the Airplane Geeks podcast, don't you?
What's that?
Well, it means that you now have 540 other episodes you can go back and listen to.
Oh, if you're crazy. Well, some people do that.
Yeah, some do.
Yeah, they do. And, of course, the other winner, Ray Davis, has been a longtime listener. So exciting for them. So both of those guys get two books from the series signed by Michael and Stefan Strasser. And so congratulations to you guys, and thanks to everybody who submitted an entry. Launchpad says we're going to have more giveaways. I don't know if he's got anything in mind or not. If he has, he hasn't talked to us. But we look forward to that. What's up with the geeks? I'll kick it off. I had my road trip to the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force in Dayton, Ohio. Great time there. I spent the entire day at the museum. I arrived at 9:30 in the morning, spent the day looking at the exhibits, talking to folks, and then in the late afternoon and evening was first a reception with Dick and Bert Rutan. And then later on, the two of them gave presentations in the theater at the museum. And when you have an opportunity to stand face-to-face with those guys and have a conversation, listen to their stories, and these brothers love to tell stories, let me tell you. They each have their own stories, but they tell them well. Quite an event. I saw listener Greg, his friend Ron, were there. I also ran across a couple of others who knew about the podcast, and it was, like I said, it was a great time. This is a two-part, I guess you could say, series. The other one is Bessie Coleman's story, Live Performance. Bessie Coleman, of course, is no longer with us, a very famous female African-American pilot. But apparently her niece has a performance that she does, and that's going to be March 14th at the museum. So you can check that out at afmuseum.com/livinghistory. And then one quick note, on the way back to Connecticut, I stopped at the Champaign Aviation Museum. And they're doing a lot of really interesting restoration work there, including a B-17 that they're putting together. So I had a great time talking with those folks on the restoration team, went out to lunch with them. Where did we go? Well, we went to the Airport Cafe at Grimes Field Airport, which is just, you know, right adjacent, one of our eatattheairport.com listings. So we got to patronize a little diner at the airport, and that was a blast as well.
You know, you were talking about brother teams, and I was lucky enough to talk with both Bert and his brother Dick at different times at Oshkosh and other places. But I was thinking about other brother teams. You know, it started out with Orville and Wilbur, mm-hmm. and then we, in addition to the Rutans, who are just absolutely giants in aviation,
yeah.
Alan and Dale Klapmeyer, who also between them started right. Cirrus and a couple of other aviation companies. Any other great brother teams out there or brother-sister teams that have, you know, been, you know, giants or legends in aviation?
Wasn't there like Jorge Whitehead, Gustav's brother or something? No. Forget, scratch that.
Groan.
But no, that's interesting, Max. Yeah. I wonder if there's some other brother or...
The Rutans,
other brother or even sister teams. I don't know if there are sister teams.
Oh, the Kellys, if you're going to talk astronauts.
Ah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Really good point. Yeah, that's excellent. And one of them, I guess, has just announced that he's running for Congress.
And one of them is now an inch taller than the other one for identical <That's right>. Twins.
Yeah, that's true.
Indeed.
All right. Anything else aviation-wise going on with you guys?
Oh, well, let me tell you about the last episode we just did of Aviation News Talk. I had a guest on the show that you probably know. We had a new feature that we introduced called Safety Moment, in which we took our expert guess and tore apart an accident and talked about it in detail. It's an interesting crash. It was an Air Force pilot who had recently completed test pilot school at Edwards Air Force Base who crashed and died in a Cirrus SR-22 while in the traffic pattern landing at his home airport in San Antonio, Texas. It's just one of those head scratchers where you just kind of ask yourself, how on earth is that possible? And so we tore it apart, and yeah, it's possible if you don't follow the standard operating procedures. But anyway, Rob Mark came on the show, and we talked about that in detail. So it was kind of a tragic event, but hopefully it's the kind of thing that will educate people about the need to follow standard operating procedures.
I'll listen for that. I'm one episode behind in Aviation News Talk podcast, so I haven't heard that one yet, but I will. Rob's showing up in a couple of different places. I heard him on
Podcasting on a Plane.
Yes, that's right. That was great. It was good to hear Rob. And speaking of good to hear from, just one quick note. We heard from Srinan. Do you remember him? He had been a regular listener for a long time. In fact, he wrote in and just recently said it's been almost 10 years. So that's almost the full length of the show.
Yeah, I remember him well. He and I did a lot of flying to help him get his FAA equivalent instrument rating and private pilot's license. He's a captain for a 787 for a major airline.
That's right. That's right. In fact, he said that he just recently made captain. He said, I started listening to the Airplane Geeks when I was just a cadet in the airline program. He says, you guys have truly been a part of my aviation journey as I progressed through the ranks, and I have certainly learned a lot from each one of you. That's very nice, Srinan. In the spirit of that, he made a contribution. It is, I think many of you know, we have a donation button on our webpage, and so Srinan made a donation there. We thank you for that very much. That's very kind. So we're glad to hear that Srinan has gotten back into the Airplane Geeks groove again and sort of restarted his listenership. Well, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest this episode was Jennifer Coutts Clay. She's the principal of J. Clay Consulting, but also the author of Jetliner Cabins, Evolution and Innovation. Highly recommended. And you can find that on the App Store at Apple. You can find that for Android on Google Play or Google Podcasts or whatever they're calling that now. You can also find that on Amazon.com. And I think it's well worth it. The website for that is jetlinercabins.com. As always, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you'd like to send us an email, we're at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. But visit the website for show notes, how to find us on social media, how to donate, how to learn more about each of us. It's all there at airplanegeeks.com. And if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, well, that's airplanegeeks.com/541. We encourage you to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, your favorite podcast app like Overcast or Pocket Casts, or everywhere. We're on Stitcher, we're on Spotify, and Airplane Geeks is also one of the select small number of podcasts. It's on Pandora. You can find us there.
And Alexa.
And don't say that out loud because then you just launch everybody's lady in the tube.
Oh, sorry.
So, Max Trescott, where do folks find you online?
Well, when I'm not at the airport like today when it was raining, I can be found behind my computer here. And you can always reach out to me at aviationnewstalk.com and just click on contacts at the top, and I'll get right back to you if you send me an email.
And David Vanderhoof.
Well, you can first find me on our Slack listener team. And if you want to find Max and I lurking there, as well as some of our other people, you can send us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll send you an invite. So join the club on the Slack listener team. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on What Just Flew By on Instagram with a lot of my new Hawaiian photographs. And of course, you can find me on Friday mornings on that show with Max talking about drones, the UAV Digest. And one last thing, I want to shout out to Mike, Safe Skies, and thanks for breakfast. It's always great when you meet up with a fellow airplane geek. And I recommend that to everybody. Go out to your local Eat at the Airport restaurant and have a geeks meet up and then send us some information. It's good to meet people who have you share your passion. So that was a really good experience, even if I had to go to Hawaii to meet Mike, but I did it anyway.
All right, great. And you can find me on LinkedIn. Look for Max Flight, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. If you want to reach me by email, it's MaxFlight@AirplaneGeeks.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. Find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments...